Starting with Linda B and Linda R. Paola, Mark, Peter, Joan, Bob K, Tyler, Paulette, Phil, Marv, Rosemary, Pat, Jeannie, Vin, Ken, Alice, Jeff O, Bob O, Amelia, and Ruth Ann. Thank you all for joining today. All right, so in terms of announcements, oh, that's quite a lot. So next Sunday, June 27th, in place of the Dharma Talk, so it would be at this time, we will be having our Jukai ceremony. So we will be having, there's seven people receiving the precepts, and three of them will be here in person. So we are going to do a in-person ceremony in the Zendo. Everybody who's in the Zendo will be vaccinated, and Bob and I and others got to figure out how this is all going to work. Cameras, computers, microphones, I don't know. We beg your pardon for next Sunday. We plan to have things set up for hybrid, you know, in-person, online stuff starting beginning of August, unless COVID stuff, you know, the trajectory changes. But looking at how things are going now, so we'll have things more. We'll be figuring things out as we go, and it should be better set up by August. Sunday, I don't know. I don't know if things will be audible or what you'll be able to see or whatever, but we're going to do our best. But it'll be kind of exciting. So yeah, please show up to witness. And those who are curious, if you are local, we're limiting the in-person ceremony at this point just to the three preceptees and four or five of us who have jobs, and then the preceptees can invite, you know, up to four people. So we want to try to keep it capped at about 19 at the Zendo at this point, so we can be socially distanced. What we're going to do in August, we'll figure it out. But so even if you're local, please just plan to attend online unless you have a specific role. But we are planning a picnic in Cedar Hills Park afterwards, although I have to say the weather prediction is not looking good for a pleasant picnic. It looks like it might be like 105 next Sunday. So I don't know. Like, I want to aspire. It'd be great because, you know, Mick and Ellen are flying in for the ceremony. It'd be lovely for them to be able to meet some people. So kind of stay tuned. There's a picnic plan, but it could be called off because of extreme heat. I don't know. Let's see. And then I will be going on sabbatical for the month of July. But the Zen Center schedule will continue as normal. I'll just be arranging for other people to lead classes and give talks and stuff like that. So it will be I could end up being kind of a sweet tradition that we go on a kind of alternative schedule for July, and it's a little more informal and stuff like that. So yeah, if you are interested in helping out with that and helping out with staffing or in helping out with leading a discussion on a Tuesday or something like that, please let me know. We still have some openings in that calendar. And then, like I said, the tentative plan is to begin in-person stuff at the beginning of August, but our intention is also to make everything accessible online the way it is now. There will be some awkward transitions, I'm sure, from a completely online event to a hybrid event. But I know there's a couple of people already who have said, you know, they're familiar with that kind of thing and how it could help out a little bit in, you know, like some of the teachers who have had to teach, you know, in a hybrid situation and stuff. So kind of looking forward to us figuring it out. Any questions or comments or other things I should announce before I begin? All right. I guess my Dharma talk is not on this topic, but it feels appropriate as participating in our community, which is a spiritual community, to acknowledge, to bear witness to what is going on in the world. And I have to confess that this morning, when I was curious how warm it was outside already, and when I saw that it's predicted to be 107 here next Saturday, I'm filled with a lot of fear. Terror might be a better word. Last summer was really scary in terms of fires, and there's no reason to think that it's going to be different this summer. So I guess in terms of bearing witness, I just wanted to acknowledge that situation and to perhaps offer a prayer that as the reality of climate change comes home to each of us in a more visceral way, that we find a way, we find an authentic and courageous way to respond, perhaps each of us in our own way, but that that we don't lose faith in our ability, in the ability of human beings to change, because we have gotten ourselves into this situation, and therefore we can get ourselves out of this, perhaps not entirely, but so let us think of that. So the talk that I prepared for today is my second one on Dogen's essay Kajo, or Everyday Activity. So about a month ago, I did my first talk on that, and we got through like two paragraphs. And today I'm going to get through another paragraph, but it's so rich that I don't want to rush it. It's not about getting through the chapter, right? It's about stewing on the teachings that are shared. So, as I mentioned last time, the value of wrestling with teachings and sometimes somewhat obscure, not terribly accessible texts is to challenge ourselves, to kind of think of it like exercise for our heart mind. So, you know, and in Japanese, like the shin, heart mind, heart is not really separate from mind. We think of them as separate. I have my emotions, I have my intellect, but we're thinking it's more of a cohesive thing. So our heart minds tend to run in particular grooves. We have things that we feel, figure we know, we have a view of the world, and it's difficult to break out of that or expand beyond it. So I feel like wrestling with the teachings and texts are something that can give our heart mind some exercise. So it's not about, you know, grasping something or walking away with some sense of like, oh yes, I know what the Dogen Fasico Kajo means now, and like something you can hold on to, but it's exercise so that afterwards, ideally, your heart mind feels a little more flexible, a little warmed up and worked out. And so that's the effort. And I have to admit, when I first read a Dogen passage, most Dogen passages, like today's, I just read it and I go, I have no idea what that's about. I have no idea what he's talking about. And here, I can't give a Dharma talk on this. What? So my first inclination is to move on. But that's part of why I've kind of committed to working through this essay, so that it's like, all right, let's see what we got here. What do we think this is? And one more note about just how to relate to Dogen. I like to think of it sometimes like poetry. So it's more evocative than explanatory. So I am using Kaz Ta-Nehisi's translation, but I also refer to a couple other translations for various purposes. In particular, so Kajo, just to revisit, this is by Reverend Hubert Nierman, who translated a version of this for Shasta Abbey. And he says, Kajo literally means what is habitual, jo, in one's home life, ka. So he says, throughout the discourse, Dogen speaks of sahan, literally tea and cooked rice, as the staples of everyday living, and that taking tea and eating rice is a metaphor for partaking of the Dharma, which spiritually nourishes us. So Dogen almost always, it seems to me, he almost always uses words that can be taken literally as well as metaphorically, simultaneously. So we're going to, today's passage talks about rice. The last passage talked about tea and rice, but talks about rice. And in a sense, we can think Dharma, right? But he also means rice. So just keep that in mind. He chooses a word that applies very, very literally, as well as pointing to something larger. So, let's see. So continuing from where we left off last time, this is very short. This is the section from Kajo. So Shurto, great master Wuji, at the Shurto hut on Mount Nanyue said, I have built a grass hut where no coins are kept. Having had rice, I am ready for a leisurely nap. Having had rice, words come, words go, words come and go, filled with Buddha ancestors' thoughts and phrases. Not yet having rice means not being satisfied. However, the point of having had rice and a leisurely nap is actualized before having rice, while having rice, and after having rice. To assume that the experience of having rice lies only after having had rice is the mere study of four or five sho, small measure of rice. So, again, this can initially strike us as kind of an annoying riddle. having rice doesn't depend on having had rice or before having rice or after having rice. It's like, why is the meaning made so obscure? Or maybe this is just too old, culturally specific, and we can't get it. Or maybe Dogen is so realized that, you know, a mere mortal can't understand what he's talking about. But I don't think any of these are true. Frankly, I think Dogen was probably just as obscure to the people at his time as he is to us. But let's just explore. So Shurto's teaching of the grass hut is well known separately from Dogen's reference. And I think So-on gave a talk on it not all that long ago. He has a whole poem, The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. So this is his grass hut. And it's open to interpretation and widely commented on. But rather than relying on other people's interpretations, let's just guess. So I have built a grass hut. So a grass hut is shelter. We need some form of shelter as human beings, depending on our environment, for warmth or protection from the sun or protection from rain or insects. So even a great Zen master like Shurto has built something to protect and take care of his life. Buddhism can seem like a pretty self-denying tradition sometimes. Monastics are renunciates living without any minimal possessions and entertainments, begging for their support. And lay practitioners may have more, but are still asked to cultivate non-attachment, generosity, to recognize the emptiness of self. But the reality of our lives is that we spend much, if not most, of our time taking care of our lives, taking care of our bodies, taking care of our minds, our responsibilities, our shelters, our relationships. So Shurto says he is, you know, so I feel like this is an acknowledgement that, you know, here we are human beings and we have to take care of this life. But Shurto says he's built a grass hut, which is pretty minimal and flimsy. It could, like I'm picturing, could blow away in too much of a storm. It's not going to last very long. And if destroyed, like the traces of it would disappear pretty quickly. So that brought the question to my mind, what kind of shelter have we built for ourselves? How long do we expect it to last? If you're anything like me, you've created much, much more than a grass hut. Physically, literally, and metaphorically. We build and live in substantial houses of hundreds or thousands of square feet, solidly built in order to last, you know, at least as long as we want it, and then we can sell it, you know, so it's supposed to last a very long time. And for our comfort and security, you know, it goes way beyond just a house, right? It goes to savings and money and plans and, you know, all kinds of things meant to take care of our lives. But as we know and are uncomfortably reminded as we watch things unfold across the world, that everything we've built, no matter how substantial it seems, can be lost in an instant. So what would it be like to be able to be satisfied with a grass hut? At times we may have experienced this kind of lightness. Even though we're not so protected or prepared, we're also freer to respond, open to adventure, less defended, more alive, less burdened by our possessions or our concern about losing them or maintaining some kind of state. This is kind of what I'm imagining Ken is moving into as he disassembles his life and is going off onto a bike tour of Europe and then on to another country. And that's what I experienced as well when I was headed to move into the Zen Center permanently, and I got rid of everything. And everything that I owned and needed, I put on a bike and I rode from Corvallis to Portland. And I've acquired a lot of stuff since then. But at that time, I mean, and for a while at the Zen Center, everything I owned just fit in a closet. Like mentally, I could do a category, you know, I could do an inventory of everything I was responsible for. And there was a lightness and a sweetness to that. So we need to remember that there's always two levels of interpretation here. So there's like the literal and the physical, and then there's what is in our heart mind. So this isn't saying that if we're a good Buddhist, we don't own a house or even rent one or live in one, or we would live in the woods in a handmade shack. We don't have any savings, wouldn't make any plans, right? That's not what this is about. But what is that state of body, mind, and heart that is being pointed at? Or we could, or maybe we can recognize that what we have built is really no more substantial than a grass hut. And can we feel at peace with that anyway? What is truly needed to be satisfied? So note that Shirto's grass hut also, it gives him a little bit of protection from the rain or cold, but certainly not protection from thieves. So we can't hoard any wealth there. There are no coins there. So our wealth is our protection against the future. It's against the future needs, future threats, future wants, which is, I'm not going to stop saving, right? But it is about the future. So what would it be like to be able to be at peace, even knowing that actually we have no guarantees about the future? So moving on, Shirto says that in his little hut, having had rice, I am ready for a leisurely nap. So again, rice can metaphorically be read as referring to Dharma. So as our Kyoju Kaiman text, our precept text says, the Dharma is the medicine for all suffering. It is also the truth realized. It is that which appears in the world and in the scriptures becoming good for others. And ultimately, it is immaculacy itself. So what is the Dharma? I mean, Dharma, we can think kind of literally, right? Okay, Buddhist teachings. But clearly, it goes beyond that. So in truth, it is what nourishes. It's what fulfills our needs and relieves our suffering. So rice can be intimacy in your relationships. It's the support of nature, which brings us water and food and clean air. It is the Buddhist teachings and practices, which you may hear and apply, and they relieve some suffering, give you some insight, help you be more appreciative of your life. It's the Sangha, which supports and encourages us. But it's also rice or pasta or vegetables or medicine or whatever. It is what nourishes and relieves suffering. So Shirto says, having had rice, I am ready for a leisurely nap. So again, the leisurely nap. Now, I can't remember exactly where this is from, so I cannot give a citation. So I guess before I make this into a podcast, I'll try to look it up. But I believe nap or sleep can be a metaphor for zazen. So once again, we have a metaphorical and literal meaning. So there's something about when we do sit, we're letting go in the same way in a similar way to when we take a nap or we go to sleep, that we're letting go, we're putting down activity, we're letting go. And it's probably our zazen's even better if our attitude is leisurely, as opposed to trying to attain something. But of course, our zazen's not sleep. It's not the same thing as sleep. We try to remain alert. And if our attitude kind of literally gets too leisurely, we're likely to kind of doze off or daydream or whatever. So it's not necessarily like literally, but it's a metaphor. And honestly, you know, the times when I've felt like my zazen has been the most right on, usually in the midst of a long meditation retreat. Because I struggle with sleepiness and zazen sometimes, particularly if I haven't gotten enough sleep. But there can actually be this point where it is the same kind of complete letting go. But instead of going into sleepiness, unless we're really tired, we don't need to be asleep. And sometimes sleepiness is just kind of an avoidance, like, you know, things aren't interesting enough right now, so I'm just going to check out. But in this moment of really still letting go, we can just remain awake, not because we're trying to remain awake, but just because there we are. But of course, if we are really exhausted, then we go to sleep, which is where this is the kind of literal meaning of this passage comes in as well, right? Sometimes it's time for a leisurely nap. Sometimes it's actually time for a nap. So Sherto may actually take a leisurely nap in his grass hut. Think of the times you have drifted off to sleep with utter contentment. If you're anything like me, these times are probably relatively rare. Even if there's not, you know, overt, obvious worry or planning or desire or anger or whatever kind of disturbing us, there's just a background level of, you know, dukkha, frankly, preoccupation. Things aren't yet exactly as they should be. You know, I've got this thing to do. I've got that thing to do. There's that unresolved thing. So there's just, you know, the contentment is elusive. But I do remember I love taking naps during meditation retreats, not on the cushion. But, you know, when there's a break, there's just something. So, like, I've not been able to usually fall asleep with that level of contentment, which elsewhere. So I see the passage we're discussing as being fundamentally about satisfaction. A deep level of contentment we usually postpone because conditions aren't yet right. But there's Sherto taking a leisurely nap in his flimsy grass hut, without a coin to his name. So what is the nature of contentment if it's not dependent on conditions? And this, I think, is the central question of Buddhism. It has been from the very beginning. In the rest of the passage, Dogen discusses having had rice. So when Dogen wrote much of the text that he wrote was written in the accessible Japanese of his time, but some passage words and phrases he would write in Chinese for presumably emphasis, right? So he's writing in Japanese and then he'd have this special, you know, the special term, and he would repeat it. So in the Ta-Nehisi translation that I'm using, these phrases that were in Chinese are italicized. So in this passage, having had rice and a leisurely nap both appear in Chinese. So it's like, and you know, got, I don't know really, you know, this is translation, right? Because in English, it's got to be a phrase, having had rice, but you know, in Chinese, it's not broken up into verbs and objects in the same way. Having had rice and a leisurely nap. So these are, we're supposed to pay attention to these. This is something special. So he says, having had rice, words come, words go, words come and go, filled with Buddha ancestors' thoughts and phrases. Not yet having rice means not yet being satisfied. So what is this having had rice? This state, this experience of having had rice. So it's unlikely to simply refer to having just stuffed your mouth with food and swallowed it, right? It's unlikely to refer to us just, you know, hearing the words of the Dharma and kind of spacing out and then forgetting about them. It's unlikely to refer to us just kind of stumbling around in our lives in a state of self-preoccupation, only half aware of the blessings that we encounter each day. Because not yet having rice, Dogen says, means not yet being satisfied. So we can have rice literally without having had rice in this deeper sense, without being truly satisfied and nourished by it. So for me, this is one of the most inspiring and sweetest aspirations, to fully experience and appreciate each moment of our life. And I also love the phrase, words come, words go, words come and go, filled with Buddha ancestors' thoughts and phrases. So this makes me think of the Dharma as nourishment, as opposed to something that should be grasped, right? Like how often, I've heard it so many times, people say, yeah, I really, you know, I love the Dharma talks. And then I'll go away and I'll be like, what was that about again? Like, what, it doesn't, it, you know, there's what, like, there's nothing often that's grasped, no understanding that's achieved. But if we think of it more as just nourishment, like, yeah, all right, done with that Dharma meal, moving on. We consume the Dharma and let it become part of us. And this process will go on throughout our lives. Now the passage, almost done here, the passage ends with something encouraging. So it can be very daunting, I think, when we aspire to be truly attentive and appreciative. Because no matter how many years we've been practicing, most of us are so far from this ideal. Most of us, it's just, you know, we're lucky if there's a few moments a day that we're just present and grateful to be breathing and notice the sunshine and, you know, that we really appreciate the significance of being alive. There might be a few moments, and then the rest of the time we're kind of just stuck in our self-preoccupation fog. So there can end up seeming like quite a gap. Like Dogen says, it can be like the gap between heaven and earth. Like, we kind of know what is possible, but the way that we really are is so far from that. And we can try, we can work on mindfulness, and we might like a little bit of progress, but it often just seems like an impossible task. But Dogen says, however, the point of having had rice and a leisurely nap is actualized before having rice, while having rice, and after having rice. To assume that the experience of having rice lies only after having had rice is the mere study of 4 or 5 show of rice. So this is the true brilliance of Dogen, which can be called radical non-duality, because it's dualistic to conceive of, on the one hand, wasting our lives in a fog of self-concern, and on the other, you know, blissfully appreciating each and every moment in an unbroken flow for the rest of our lives. So that's And this dualism is useful to contemplate. You know, what about it? There is another way to be. There are other choices to make. So it's a useful dualism, but if we get stuck there, then that's just more dissatisfaction. We get stuck there, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of the Dharma. So in other words, putting his words into other words, to assume the experience of true nourishment from the Dharma, from nature, from our relationships, from rice, happens only once or only when we've achieved this spiritual state of having had rice. Only when we become consciously appreciative and satisfied in any given moment. This is what Dogen says is the mere study of 4 or 5 cups of rice, right? If you like, imagine somebody reading this passage and then they're like, let me see. And they go into the kitchen and they get out their rice and they pour it into, you know, cups. And they're like, let's see, I mean, it's like, no, you're missing the point. Don't get stuck on the whole rice thing, right? It's too limited an understanding if we think that somehow this state of grace, if you will, is dependent on our level of spiritual achievement. Instead, Dogen says the point of having had rice and a leisurely nap is actualized before having rice, while having rice, and after having rice. How wonderful. We are being nourished and supported all the way along. So at certain points, we become more conscious of this. We wake up to it. We can appreciate it. We can even feel some satisfaction and contentment, some fearlessness. And that's wonderful. That is something that we seek in our practice. But even when we're not there, all of that is still the case. All of that support and nourishment is still around us. So I will leave it there for comments and questions. Go ahead and unmute yourself or raise your electronic hand by going down to reactions. If you have anything to add or say. Ken.
Wow, that was really powerful. When I wasn't concentrating on my cheeseburger, I was listening attentively. sorry. It's really this what's the word that you use? Fascicle, is really, really strikes true with me at this stage in my practice. Beginning, like, I want to write like tea and rice and put it on my bike somewhere, like, and use it as like my slogan for the next several months. Because cycling really does, it is an opportunity to just totally clear your head and listen to the birds of prey flying overhead and the rivers rushing. And so although like the one side of my brain is completely terrified, this bit from Dogen gives me great support and comfort. Okay.
You reminded me of a time when I was, that time when I got rid of everything and I moved to the Zen Center to live and in order to get ordained and it really worried my dad, who's very practical and had invested a lot in a good college education for me. So I, you know, be able to live a comfortable life and fulfilling life. And so he expressed his concern at one point. He just says, I'm just afraid that at some point you're just going to be, you know, living in some dingy apartment somewhere, just eating rice and drinking tea. And I didn't tell him, like, I don't think you really meant to choose that exact phrase, because it sounds like, yeah, like the exact perfect pinnacle of Zen realization.
Absolutely.
Did I miss anybody? I guess I can, you know, stimulate the conversation by asking, when have you touched this state of unconditional satisfaction or contentment or fearlessness? Can you think of a time or a situation, a moment? Peter.
You didn't give me a chance to hope that I would get called on. There's two things I want to talk about briefly, and both of them have to do with bicycling. Three times I've started, twice I've finished 1,200 kilometer bike rides. And it is during these rides that I have experienced what I suggest you're probably asking about, in that I had courage. I just had a flexibility. I was living on the bike with the intention of experiencing what it's like to cover the 754 miles reasonably. It wasn't a race, but we're all doing it to, you know, to do it, to get it over with, to say we've done it, but also to, you know, I'm making fun of us, but at the same time, I wanted to do the ride. You know, it's amazing to me how often I see people starting these rides, and then after about 10% of the ride completed, it seems to be prematurely all about getting to the finish. And I'm like, that's just so silly. And inside of that ride, between the start and the finish, is an opportunity to enjoy every inch of it. And to, you know, even treasure the difficulties, knowing that they won't last. Like, as long as you don't quit, as long as you're on trail and, you know, you have the ability to sit on the curb and wait for time to go by before you feel better, because there is some suffering on most any ride if you're given long enough. And the other topic I wanted to bring up is the Transamerica bike race, which I expect most of you are unaware of, but it started in Astoria, Oregon on June 6th. It is a self-supported race that goes over Adventure Cycling's Transamerica route. Adventure Cycling is a nonprofit organization based in Missoula, Montana, and the route does touch on Missoula before diving south through Yosemite and then starting east from about Pueblo, Colorado. The winners typically take about 17 days, and they are about 3 days from 17 days at this point. So if you were to go on Transamerica Bike Race and see that, you could become a dot watcher watching these 35 little dots slowly make their way across the continent. I'm not suggesting you do, but I consider entering this race myself in future years. It's always held in June when the days are longest. And the reason I bring it up is to not entice you to look at it, but that is yet another opportunity where I think that had we done this race, we would be raising our hands and saying, when I did the TABR, all I needed to do was hydrate, eat rice, and pedal. You know, life became very simple, as Ken can probably sympathize. It's like, that's what I need to do. I just need to be able to respond to the circumstance. Here comes a hurricane. I'm going to shelter down for a few hours. Okay, I can come back out and my head's out of my shell and I can move down the road.
What a beautiful, it's like just a perfect metaphor for like the journey of life, right? Like when you said, like every race is gonna have some suffering. Every journey. I like it. Paula.
I would say moments where I felt very satisfied and having had rice is we live on a farm here in Ontario, and I have a horse that I rescued. He was feral, not a Mustang, but bred on a farm not far from here and then not handled at all. And the halter grew into his head, and it had to be ripped off by somebody. And he came to live with me because the lady where the property was losing her land. And I knew nothing about feral horses. And those moments of deep satisfaction and meaning have come when I've connected to him on a very deep level, and we've been able to communicate. And he's an amazing teacher about myself. And the day I was able to ride him to the back of our farm and then back again, and we were connected, that's all I needed. And just if you try to, with horses that are feral and not handled, especially this one, his name is Blaze, which is like calling a dog with spots spot. Like, it's not a very exciting name. He has a white blaze on his face. But if you over communicate and put too many concepts and too much stuff with him, he'll say it. He's a very good teacher. It has to be, he's very, very sensitive. It's very minimal energy you put in there. You have to be able to have a nap all the time with him because he's so sensitive. You can't have too much energy around and too many concepts. And in Canada, you know, we have a horrible thing of horse slaughter. So my aim with him is to protect him from anything like that. So that was my experience of that. And it still is every day when I go up.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah. Thank you. Other folks? Rosemary.
Perhaps one time or the times when I experience it is in the classroom, when I'm teaching my kids in the state school. And sometimes I reserve an hour for them to make groups and teach each other on any subject that they're having problems on. And they write on the board which subjects, and then they form groups, and then they have to choose a leader and or a teacher, and they're often about groups of three or four. And then for 45 minutes, they teach each other. And they know that the leader has to be pleasant and will get feedback from the group, and the group has to be pleasant and respectful of the leader. And it's in those hours that they learn the most. And I just stand there for 45 minutes at the front with a big grin on my face. And it's really intensive learning then, very intense. And they're really into it. And yeah, I'm saying, oh, no, you stupid thing. It's like this. Don't you get it? Blah, blah, blah. But I think that's those are the hours where the most learning goes on. Mm. And where I disappear completely, which is easy with teenagers because they're really good at like making adults disappear. But it's a really, really nice form of disappearing. I love it. And for me, having stood on the stage where I used to be very present, but that wasn't always great, I find this 180 degrees different presence, i.e. disappearing presence, much more satisfying. And there's a great warmth and joy that wells up in me in those moments. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy. I don't have to prepare those lessons and they work the best.
Oh, I love it. Mark.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I prefer the kind of bicycle that pedals itself, but I don't need to resort to motorcycle stories for this. I was in the park this morning and I heard this rattling racket, and I looked behind me, and on this tiny, tiny little twig that couldn't possibly support it, but it did, was a red squirrel destroying a nut and eating it and dropping the shell on the paved path. And you have these moments where we usually yeah-butt our way out of really noticing, but there are moments where you can't deny that there's something that can be relied on, right? And when you know that there's this treasure puts a value on it, right? But when you know that there's this treasure that can be relied on, that can always be relied on, then, you know, it's that way in which taking the nap depends on eating the bowl of rice, right? Normally we're ignoring the bowl of rice. I was about half incoherent, but that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, what people are saying makes me think about, you know, feel like I've experienced, if you will, having had rice and being able, therefore, to take a leisurely nap. As, you know, during retreat, I think there's some moments, and the beautiful thing about that in particular is just it's not attached to anything, right? So it's so clearly unconditional. It's not about having to be in a particular place, I guess kind of retreat, but you know, it's not about a beautiful experience or something. And yet another place that I experience it is listening to music that really touches me. And, you know, it's like, I guess like a number of people have been pointing to, there's just something beyond us. There's something bigger. There's something beautiful. And I always think when I hear music, because a lot of times, honestly, I've thought throughout my life, I've been very oriented toward, I don't even really like to say the environment, as if this is, it's just like a house we live in. It's like we're inseparable from nature, right? But whatever. I'm very, you know, oriented toward that. And therefore, really kind of had a low opinion of human beings, generally speaking. Not individuals, not you all, but like human beings as a species, like you haven't been very beneficial for the world. And yet, you know, in certain times, in certain places, and with music, I just think, you know, even if we all go down in flames, we'll be singing. And that's like this unconditional beauty. Ruth-Ann, did you want to say something?
Yes, thank you. All these stories, and especially your last comment, is very encouraging, because we, at any kind of experience, have that full gift of life, even when it's just a nanosecond. It's sort of like being in the zone where your small self disappears. And I have a question with this sweet verse that you shared from Dogen just today. I just see it as a verse. What could he possibly be writing after that? Because I thought, well, that's it. That's complete. If we never hear Dogen again, you know? So I just thought, how does he possibly follow that? Thank you.
That's a great question, Ruth Ann. And frankly, I think, you know, as somebody who now like teaches Zen supposedly, right? You just kind of say the same thing over and over, more or less, you know, different words, different phrases, whatever. But then I guess if we think about it in terms of that, like Dharma nourishment, you know, because frankly, right? I don't know, a month from now, I won't remember this passage. Then I'll need to hear another inspiring passage. So it's true though, like oftentimes with the teaching, like you really could, if you wanted to, you could just write down one passage and then just that could be it for the rest of your life. You could just explore this one and let all the other things go. But we get bored, we want to move on to something else. Want to hear some different music. Jeff.
Can you guys hear me okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for the talk and all the sharing. It's been helpful. I was thinking of something that I heard years ago in another context. You can't get enough of what you don't need. And I was thinking about the grass hut is kind of the ephemeral or changing nature of, you know, every moment in life. Like it's all a grass hut one after another. And that the tea and the rice to me was sort of getting what you need in the grass hut of the moment. You know, that the tea and rice actually is conditional and different in each moment, in each grass hut. But that it's about, it's my experience with it has been usually very simple moments with simple things of getting what I need in that moment. And so that's what it had me thinking about.
I like that. I imagine I'm not alone in contemplating all the terrible shit that could happen, you know, in my life or beyond. What if this happened? What if that happened? What if I get terribly sick? What if, you know, my family member gets terribly, what if I lose all my, you know, money? And I don't know, like, just what would I do? Who would I be? How could I cope? You know, it's a source of anxiety, but, and it's difficult to connect with this, but I think when we have more of those experiences, like people have been talking about, kind of just, you know, the times in our life where we have set everything aside and we've been living a little bit more on the edge, even if it's just kind of a temporary choice, like the reward of discovering our own resilience and the responsiveness of the universe. And like you're saying, it changes. What we need might be different. How the universe responds to it might be different. And I don't know, we learn and grow. I mean, my example was backpacking. And for a while, I went backpacking, go backpacking by myself. And I went backpacking up this, like, I was not all that experienced and a little bit ambitious. And I climbed up and I was at a high elevation and it was really, really cold. And I got a sense that if I did not keep moving and then get immediately into my sleeping bag and bivy sack and get myself something warm to eat, that I would get hypothermic by myself in the middle of freaking nowhere where nobody knew I was. But like coming after that and realizing like we're empowered by that sense of like, I can survive. I can do that. I can figure that out. There's a certain freedom that comes from that, which is probably a good thing to keep in mind when we're trying to like keep our not grass hut, our big substantial house and framework around us, and we're worried about that giving way, to remember like, we're more resilient than we think. Well, we've come to the end of our time. So yes. Thank you all for being here, abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Domio.
Thanks for being here.